Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, December 13th, 2012. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Mitch Steele, brewmaster for Stone Brewing Company, joins us to talk IPAs, their history, and some tips on how to brew them. Mitch will field your questions from Facebook and from Twitter as well. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site, especially during this busy holiday season. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us first and go to our website, basicbrewing.com. Click on the associate or link there, the Amazon ad, and that you'll be taken to Amazon after that. And then you can shop as usual, and we get a little piece of whatever you purchase. It won't cost you any extra, which is the beautiful thing, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly, greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers, Homebrewers Association on our site, too. They work the same way. And you can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores, and the Android podcast app is on Amazon.com as well. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app, too. Plenty of time left for Santa to order your new Basic Brewing Brewer's Logbook before Christmas. Our latest version has been modified with a brewing calendar in the front that will give you 12 months of tracking your brews no matter what time of year you buy it. You can log the details of 50 batches of beer in the back, and you can find them easily with the new table of contents on the inside cover. So check that out. You can see previews of those pages on our shop at basicbrewingshop.com. I've been getting a bunch of fun brewing disaster stories for this year's Brewing Disaster episode. Steve and I are going to record that here pretty soon. So remember, please get your story to me by this Friday the 14th. The folks at Brew Hauler are sending us goodies to give us prizes to our favorite stories. So looking forward to recording that with Steve. That's always a fun show. Now let's get right to the meat of the matter. Mitch Steele was very generous with his time to talk about IPAs. His book is called IPA, Brewing Techniques, Recipes, and the Evolution of India Pale Ale. Mitch Steele, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
I have to say that you've got to have the most manly name in American craft beer.
Yeah. People call me the spy or the, you know, or porn star. That's a fun one, too. Yeah.
you could have been named after a Quinn Martin production in the 70s.
Yeah, exactly.
Now,
I can see it now.
Now you are the brewmaster at one of the American craft beer powerhouses at Stone. But you have spent some time, a lot of craft beer lovers might consider the dark side. You worked for Anheuser-Busch for a while, right?
I did. I was with Anheuser-Busch for 14 years. I had a great career there. I started off craft brewing. I was in a little brew pub in Hollister, California, when I first started brewing professionally. And that brewery never really went where we hoped it was going to go for a lot of reasons. But, you know, it got to the point where I wanted to do something with a career and learn some things. And I was sending some resumes out, and I got some interest from Anheuser-Busch. And I ended up going to Fort Collins, Colorado, to Anheuser-Busch, and I told myself I'd give it 5 years and see how things worked out, you know, and at the very least I'd walk away from it with some really good knowledge about how to brew in a large brewery and how to make consistent beer and just pick up some things to make me a better brewer. The career turned out turned out pretty well. I ended up staying with Anheuser-Busch for 14 years and did some really cool things that a lot of people didn't get to do as a normal course of a career path. So I had a really great career at Anheuser-Busch. I learned a lot. It's taught me more than any other experience about how to brew beer. And, you know, you can't say enough about how they approach their brewing process, you know, and whether people like the beer or not, you know, that's one thing. But I tell you, that is, or at least it was when I was there, that is a big team of very dedicated technical brewers, and they know their stuff. You know, whether they approach things the same way now that InBev has taken them over, I can't really say. You know, but at the time, I mean, if I wanted to know about German brewing heritage and German brewing techniques, there was no better place to be than Anheuser-Busch, unless I was in Germany.
So I take it that you spend a lot of time defending them.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, it was endless, you know. And, you know, like I said earlier, I understand that the people that like craft beer don't like the beer, but and the marketing, you know, that Anheuser-Busch does is a turnoff for a lot of people, and I get that, you know. But I always got a little defensive when people said the beer was cheap, because it wasn't. I mean, the malt and the, you know, that they use in the beers and the hops were of the best quality available, and yeah, they didn't use a lot of hops in the beer, and they used rice. And, you know, interestingly enough, the rice is actually more expensive than malt. Mm. You know, so it wasn't done to cheapen the cost of the brewing process or the beer. It was done for flavor or lack of flavor, you know, however you want to put it. But, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions out there that people, you know, that I found myself defending. But, you know, I had a good career there, and they certainly taught me a lot. You know, I certainly learned a lot at Anheuser-Busch about how to brew beer consistently, how to run taste panels, how to deal with quality issues and things like that. It was a really great experience.
And that's got to come in handy as Stone is growing. You know, as you're increasing capacity and you're getting bigger toys to play with and such as that, that experience at Anheuser-Busch has got to come in handy.
Oh, of course. You know, it's about, you know, looking at different ways to accomplish what you want to accomplish, you know, as far as monitoring your beer or making sure the quality is consistent. You know, do you want to go a complete sensory route? Do you want to have analytical? Do you want to rely on analyticals, use analyticals as a backup to your taste? You know, which was how Anheuser-Busch did it. They always, you know, any flavor discrepancies in the beer, it was all based on a taste panel, you know. And then they would use analytical data to back up and try and figure out what was causing the difference in the taste. But taste was always the primary driver for any sort of concerns or process changes or anything like that. And I've kind of adopted that here at Stone. I mean, we use our taste panel as kind of the overriding factor as to whether the beer is doing what it should do and tastes like it should taste. So, and then we use the analytical stuff to kind of back that up.
So machines can only tell you so much.
Right. I mean, beer's a sensory product, you know. You're going to drink it, you're going to taste it, you're going to smell it. So if you're not evaluating your beer that way, then you're missing the boat, in my opinion.
So let's talk IPAs. I mean, you've got this book on IPAs. I know that a lot of people will go straight to the end of the book, to the recipes.
Yeah.
But I like history, and I like it when myths are sort of debunked or modified by fact. So give me your impression of the IPA myth and how your research kind of changed your mind about that.
Well, yeah, when I first started learning about India Pale Ale back in the, I think it was the late 80s or maybe the early 90s, you know, and you hear the story of, you know, that it was invented by Hodgson in England as a beer specifically designed to survive the trip to India. And it turns out that that's more conjecture or an embellished truth rather than the actual fact. And it looks like that it was more serendipitous, you know, that Hodgson was brewing this beer and it did very well over in India and kind of set the standard for what the India Pale Ale was going to be. But you know, it sounds, it certainly looks like from all the evidence that's been collected so far, and you know, we're talking, you know, advertising lists and taste notes and personal correspondence and things like that. And I did not find all this stuff on my own. Most of this I found through other beer writers who've already uncovered this. But it certainly looks like that Hodgson was brewing a strong pale ale as part of his regular lineup, and then he started shipping it to India alongside his porter, and the pale ale really, really kind of took off. And unfortunately, you know, with Hodgson, with the Bow Brewery, there's no documentation left from that brewery. It's long gone. So nobody really knows for sure, but you can draw some conclusions by looking at what the Burton brewers were trying to do in the 1820s when they first started trying to compete with Hodgson, and how they, you know, some of the documentation involved with that and how they were trying to brew the beer. But it certainly looks like that Hodgson did not invent anything or come up with this special beer, because he never advertised it like that. It was always just Hodgson's pale ale. And, you know, Hodgson's pale ale, Hodgson's porter, and, you know, on the shipping documents and on the advertisements and things like that. So it never said anything about being a beer specifically brewed for India, you know, up until about 1835, when there was starting to be some competition. And I believe the first use of the word India pale ale happened in the late 1820s. And that was, gosh, that was, you know, 40, 50 years after Hodgson started sending beer to India. So, you know, it certainly looks like that he was shipping the beer, and the kind of the name and the style, you know, guidelines and everything kind of came later.
And this type of beer was not the only type of beer being successfully shipped over to India, according to your book. The myth is that they brewed this stronger, hoppier beer to survive the trip, but you say that there were other styles that were sort of less, you know, more fragile, that did well over there.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing to realize is that brewers long before Hodgson knew that if they put hops in a cask of beer that was on a boat, it was going to do better than if they didn't. So that was not a technique that Hodgson developed. That was a technique that was pretty widespread use. So the extra hopping piece was not necessarily part of the India trip. You know, that wasn't part of the recipe formulation. It was just standard procedure. You know, any beer that went on a boat got an extra dose of hops in the barrel. There's a lot of documentation that shows porter was shipped alongside pale ale to India in the early days, and it's. The troops in India, the English army, still preferred porter all the way through the 1800s, and it was more the upper middle class, the higher class colonists in India that really latched onto the India Pale Ale. But both beers were shipped successfully, and then there's documentation that I found that shows that mild ale and other beers were also shipped as well. And, you know, so, you know, it's just that I think what happened was that this particular beer just really took off as being something kind of special. And whether that was due to the climate in India and kind of the, you know, the intense humidity and heat and things like that, whether this beer just was more refreshing, you know, certainly may have played a role in that. It's interesting because really the only claim that Hodgson invented a special beer came 100 years after Hodgson started shipping beer to India. It was in a book about Burton on Trent, and the writer gave credit to Hodgson for inventing this style that the Burton brewers later adapted and started brewing themselves. And, you know, that was the first reference to Hodgson ever inventing anything special, you know, or going through this process of invention and beer formulation specific for India. So most beer historians now don't think that Hodgson actually was quite that calculated in what he was trying to do. It was just that he was shipping beer to India. And one of the reasons his beer was so successful was that the brewery was located right next to the India docks. So he was able to work some business deals with the officers on those boats and get the beer on the boats pretty easily. And the fact that he was shipping a pale ale and a porter, the pale ale took off, but you know, that kind of what drove his success, as well as the beer itself.
So what's the character of this historical British IPA?
You know, there's not any real documentation about Hodgson's beer except some taste notes that it could be very bitter. It could be varying in quality and clarity. The real documentation comes when the Burton Brewers, when Salt and Bass and Alsop started brewing their own versions in the 1820s, and then it becomes very clear what the beer was. It was a very golden colored beer. It was bitter, probably, you know, it was probably analytically very similar to today's craft brewed IPAs, you know, 16 to 17 degrees Plato starting gravity, 6 to 7% alcohol by volume, probably 60 to 70 bitterness units. You know, that's what most people think. There's certainly some excellent documentation on the analytical characteristics of IPAs that come later in the century, and also some documentation on how the beer was brewed. And one of the best documentations came from the British military, and they had very strict guidelines for how IPA needed to be brewed. And it's a wonderful document that's in the book. You know, but it was a very light colored golden. It was very clear. It was one of the first beers brewed in England that was served cold, you know, and not you know, kind of at cellar temperature, but actually cold. And you know, some very distinguishing characteristics. It was very clear, golden. They use vernacular like a peculiar fine flavor, but you know, it was compared to champagne in some circles, and you know, so it had this crispness and this delicateness that I don't think people realized was in that beer.
And it was aged for quite a long time. I mean, there was the transported versions were aged because they were on the ships, but there were also domestic versions that were aged as well, right?
Well, yeah, it's quite interesting, and this is one of the things that kind of blew me away when I was starting to research this. But the beer was aged. The India Pale Ale was only brewed in the fall, and as a rule, the brewers used the freshest malt and the freshest hops. So they were using like from that year's harvest, and they'd use that preferentially in the IPA. That was a very high class, high level beer for these brewers. And they would only brew it from, say, October through December or January. And then the beer would go through primary fermentation after 7 days, 8 days, whatever it took. The beer was then put into casks and aged through the summer. So the beer typically was 8 or 9 months old, aged in a cask before it even got put on a boat to go to India. And it's... you know, a couple of things that were going on there. Number one, you know, is that they didn't have the refrigeration control or the temperature control in the breweries, you know, that we enjoy now. So the fermentations would stall out due to the coldness of, you know, in Burton-on-Trent or wherever, you know, it gets fairly cold in the winter. So the fermentations would peter out. And then as the beer warmed up again in the summer, the brewers would debung or loosen the bungs on the barrels and let the fermentation proceed until it was very dry and the beer was completely fermented. And what that allowed was to put the beer barrels on a boat and then not have those barrels explode. And that seemed to be a fairly early problem with shipping the beer anywhere, was that the barrels sometimes would generate enough pressure to literally explode on the boat. And so, you know, that was a big part of the whole IPA process in the 1800s, was this really long aging time in England before the beer was even loaded on a boat. And then, you know, and the domestic beer was treated the same way. So it was aged, you know, in big warehouses across the country. And then the brewers didn't have their own bottle shops, so they would, you know, work with like a bottler to bottle the beer, you know, off-site away from the brewery. And I thought that was kind of interesting as well.
So that may have had something to do with the clarity of the beer, right? I mean,
oh, absolutely, yeah. They had a lot of time to let that stuff settle out, and you know, and the other thing that really helped with the clarity of the beer was the Burton water, you know, with a high mineral content that enhances yeast settling. And so you had a couple of things working in the Burton Brewers' favor. They were able to get this really clear beer. It was, you know, one of the interesting things that when Steve Wagner, who's the president of Stone, and I went over to England and we're doing some research for this book, and we met up with a bunch of brewers, retired brewmasters from Bass and Marston's and Burton-on-Trent. And one of the common themes that came out of the discussions we had with them was that the beer was deliberately brewed to be as light as possible in color. And that meant that they undersized their wort kettles, the boiling kettles, so that they could not get this really intense boil. And they tended to boil for a very long time at a low intensity, and really did not want to have any color development in the boil, which is kind of contrary to the way that we approach kettle boiling today.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then, you know, the whole thing about this beer was make it as light in color as possible, make it as clear as possible. And there were a lot of things done to try and enhance those things. The malt that they used in the beer was developed by, I believe it was Allsop, but it was a very lightly kilned, lighter than normal kilned pale ale malt. You know, so it was kilned at a much lower temperature and had just very little color, you know, almost like a Pilsner malt today.
And then the water character at Burton really had an impact on the character of the hoppiness of the beer.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty well documented. You know, what Burton water with the high calcium, the magnesium, the sulfate contents, how that you can have really high bitterness levels and get this nice hop intensity without getting the harshness. You know, so you can make a really bitter beer, and it can be very bitter, but it doesn't come across as harsh. And you know, that's one advantage that that I think the Burton brewers had over Hodgson and some of the other London brewers was that the water made a better beer for this particular style of beer. And what was interesting is that later in the 1800s, there were breweries from London that just simply packed up and relocated to Burton-on-Trent so they would get the water themselves. And, you know, or they set up separate satellite breweries in Burton-on-Trent. And then, you know, later on in the very late 1800s, early 1900s, water chemistry was a little bit better understood. So people started, you know, really trying to replicate the water through the addition of salts and such.
And talk about the hopping strategy that they used. I mean, they used hops in the boil, right? But then they also put a ton of hops as dry hopping as well.
Yeah, the dry hopping could be anywhere from like, you know, 2 to 3, 4 pounds per barrel. I mean, it was just insane, you know, what they were doing. I mean, you know, at Stone here, you know, I was amazed when I got here from, you know, from Anheuser-Busch. You know, we were looking at, you know, if we ever did a dry hop beer, 1/4 pound, 1/2 pound per barrel kind of thing. And I get to Stone and we're doing 3/4 to 1.5 to 2 pounds per barrel in the dry hop. The biggest beer we've ever done, I think, as far as hopping was, you know, 3 or 4 pounds, and we've only done that once. But, you know, it's, yeah, they were using massive amount of hops. And, of course, you know, we're talking the preferred hop for the IPA was the East Kent Goldings, which is a pretty low-intensity hop, you know, compared to hops today. Flavor intensity and that kind of thing, low alpha acids and such. But even so, you know, people have done the work and said, okay, if you're using 6 pounds per barrel of East Kent Goldings, you're going to get 70 IBUs in the beer. And then, you know, if you're adding another, you know, few pounds per barrel in the dry hop, it's going to be pretty intense. And even with the age, and that's kind of what is I find fascinating, is even though this beer was aged for, you know, 9 months before it even got onto a boat, and then he had another 6-month boat ride. By the time the beer got to India, it still apparently had a very distinct East Kent Goldings hop character to it.
Hmm. Now, you talk about the evolution of the style as tastes change over the years, and they got smaller and a bit, you know, wimpier over time. But I was surprised to see or to hear that there was a sort of an authentic version brewed here in the United States up until the 60s.
Yes, Ballantine IPA. You know, I've never had a Ballantine IPA. I would love to try one sometime. But Ballantine was like, you know, back in the late 1800s before Prohibition, there were several breweries in the Northeast that were brewing IPAs. And in fact, IPAs were being brewed all over the world. But, you know, once Prohibition hit and all these regional breweries started closing and many of them didn't, you know, survive through Prohibition and reopen, Ballantine's was one that did, and they kept brewing their IPA through the 1960s, and then in the late 1960s, Ballantine got bought by Falstaff, I believe, and then you start getting into some accounting driven decisions, and the beer got kind of dumbed down. But you know, the original Ballantine apparently was 70 to 80 IBU beer. It was a deep amber beer. And it was aged for a year in wood vats before it was released. So it went through kind of a similar process. One thing I saw with the brewers in the United States, they may not be using barrels to age their IPA like they did in England, but they were using wood tanks and wood casks. And then they had this very unique dry hopping process where they created a distillation of hop oils from bouillon hops and then added that back to the beer as it sat in those aging tanks. So you ended up with this beer that had this really soft character due to the age, and then it had this intense hop character. I can only imagine what it tasted like because I've never had one, but you know, I've had people describe it to me, and it sounds phenomenal.
Well, maybe someone will make a clone one day.
So, yeah, I think people have tried. you know, and who knows? Who knows if they've succeeded in cloning the beer? But it certainly would be. I certainly would love to try them.
So I know we could. We've got a limited amount of time, and I solicited for questions out there on Facebook and Twitter. So I want to get to those, but give us the Reader's Digest version of kind of how we came from the traditional English IPA to what we've got now as the, you know, what's known as the American IPA.
Well, you know, I think really you have to look at the Ballantine IPA as being kind of the bridge between the English IPA of the late 1800s and the craft brewed IPA of today. Certainly, it's well described how Ken Grossman at Sierra Nevada and Fritz Maytag at Anchor were inspired by the original Ballantine IPA to brew something similar. And really, craft brewed IPA craft brewers, you know, in the 80s who were starting to brew IPA certainly looked at Liberty Ale from Anchor Brewing Company and Celebration Ale from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. Both those beers were inspired by the original Ballantine beer. So you've got this kind of tree, you know, that this family tree coming off of the Ballantine thing. And then you have Anchor Liberty Ale, which was released in, I believe, 1975, and then Celebration Ale, which came a few years later, 1981. You know, and brewers... And those beers the brewers didn't refer to those beers as IPAs, but when people started brewing IPA, certainly they looked at Celebration Ale and Liberty Ale for inspiration and kind of as a starting point. And it's fun. I was brewing in the Bay Area in the late 1980s and early 1990s at the Pub Brewery in Hollister, and I remember brewers up in the Bay Area brewing these IPAs that were just, I mean, it was just so intensely hoppy, you know, for the time. And I just loved it. I was just like, oh, my God, this beer tastes like pure hops, you know. And, you know, and this is, you know, these were not intense beers by today's standards. But at the time, they were groundbreaking, you know. And it was like, you know, I remember Rubicon's IPA you know, some of the IPAs being brewed at Triple Rock and some of the other Bay Area breweries has just kind of blown my socks off. And, you know, and they all, admittedly, they all took their inspiration from Ken Grossman and Fritz Maytag, who took their inspiration from Ballantine. So it's kind of a neat story, I think.
Yeah, and the yeast that Sierra Nevada has made famous apparently came from Ballantine.
Yeah, that's the story. I remember Ken asking Ken Grossman that when we talked with him, and he wouldn't officially confirm that, but he said that's what they say. So I kind of left it as nebulous there in the book, you know, because he wouldn't come right out and say, yeah, that is the yeast. But that's the conventional wisdom is that the Sierra Nevada yeast was the Ballantine yeast. And it certainly is a great yeast for brewing IPA because it's very clean. It doesn't produce a lot of esters or a lot of diacetyl and really allows the hops to come through.
Yeah. And now we've got the world where we've got Imperial IPAs or double IPAs. We've got these American hop bombs that are just incredible with the amount of flavor and complexity that American brewers, including yourself, are able to pull out of the hops. You know, it's just I'd be curious to know what the brewers of the regional IPAs would think about those things.
Yeah, I think just judging by the reaction I get from British brewers about our IPA, I would think it would have to be an acquired taste. You know, it's the hop character is so different now. It's we have so many different hop varieties available to us, and that's, you know, kind of what IPA has become, is just this showcase for new hops and new hop combinations and blends and things, you know. And if you think back, East Kent Goldings and Bullion and hops like that are much different, you know. So I think you'd have a totally different. I know when we were in England, we brought bottles of Stone Ruination IPA, and the brewers in Burton liked that one. They thought the hop character was really nice in it, and it was, you know, definitely American is what they said. But they said they enjoyed it. When we poured them Stone Sublimely Self-Righteous Ale, which is our black IPA, they weren't as keen on that one. it was like, well, wow, that's a bit much, isn't it? You know.
Oh, they'll come around.
Yeah, exactly. You know, everything's an acquired taste, and I think that's what we're seeing in the general public right now is, you know, everybody. You know, people walk into places and want to taste the IPA first, you know, and it's really an interesting phenomenon because I remember, you know, 20 years ago when I was brewing at San Andreas and Hollister, Bill just said, well, people in this town can't handle an IPA and it's too strong and it's too hoppy. And, you know, I don't think it'll work. So I don't want you to brew one. And, and I'm like, oh, you know, come on, you know, and yeah, never was able to talk him into it. But, today, if you don't have an IPA, you're the exception rather than the rule.
Right, right. Well, let's get into talking about how to brew these things. I mean, especially an American IPA. That's what most of the questions were about. They were about hops. I mean, it's all about the hops. That's what the American IPA is all about.
Of course, yep.
So what do you think about when you're designing a recipe for an IPA? I mean, what are the factors around hops that you look at? I mean, you've got some really good information about developing the hop recipe and calculating bitterness. What are the factors that you think are the most important?
Well, it depends on the beer, and I can't give. It's hard for me to give a blanket answer on this one because I'm always trying new things. But I can tell you a couple of things that we look at. Number one, the bittering hop, we want it to be a clean hop. You know, we don't want we've used hops like Columbus and Chinook in bittering IPAs, and I don't really like that because the character comes through as a bit harsh at times, and it depends on the recipe. These are generalizations, not absolutes. But in my opinion, you want a nice, clean, bittering hop. We like Warrior. We've used Magnum a lot. You know, hops like that don't have a lot of flavor intensity but provide a nice, clean bitterness. I know a lot of people look at Cohumulone. I'm not completely sold on that. There's contradictory evidence out there as to whether Cohumulone gives you more or less harshness. The conventional wisdom, the early research was that beers or hops that had Cohumulone levels over 30 parts per million were going to give you or 30% or whatever. I don't even know what the measurement stands. I think it's 30% of total oils. If you have Cohumulone levels higher than that, the bitterness could come across as being harsh. And that was done, a lot of work by by big brewers researched that. And I know Anheuser-Busch believed that very strongly. But there has been some contradictory evidence produced. So I, you know, in general, I think there are some hops that have higher cohumulone levels that will work fine in an IPA. But, you know, in general, we tend to go for the cleaner bittering hops. You know, a couple of things. You know, when I got to Stone, the beers here were formulated, most of the core beers were formulated before I got here. And it was interesting to see that you know, at Anheuser-Busch, we always use 10 to 12 different hop varieties in a particular beer. And at Stone, it was more like one or two varieties, you know, a bittering variety and then a flavor variety. And then the flavor variety would also be the same variety used in the dry hop for a dry hop beer, which I thought was interesting. And I think it's made really good beers. But I've tried to get away from that a little bit with the newer beers and the Enjoy by IPA that we brew. We use 11 different hop varieties. And, you know, part of that is to make sure that if we have some supply issues, which a lot of brewers are struggling with, that we can make some recipe adjustments without it being, you know, without it being too noticeable in the beer. You know, if we run out of a certain variety, it's really only 10% of the total hop component, and if we have to change it, we can change it and keep the beer profile the same. Whereas with Stone IPA, which is, you know, 99% Centennial in the flavor, you know, if we ran out of Centennial hops, we'd be screwed. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't like being in that position. So we've taken, with some of the more recent IPAs, we've taken a little different approach and using more blends. One of the things that we did with the Stone Enjoy by IPA is we used that kind of a adaptation of the hop bursting technique, which I kind of came across through homebrew circles, and it sounded interesting to me. And I know there's some professional brewers that use it, and I wanted to try it in a beer. And so we did use some bittering hops in the beer, but the bittering hops, the early boil hops, only contribute 40% of the total bitterness to the beer. And the rest of the bitterness is coming from late kettle additions and whirlpool additions. So we really stacked it up on the back end. And the thinking, you know, what I understand, the thinking is that the bitterness is going to come across as very mellow as compared to harsh, and you're going to get a lot more flavor complexity and that kind of thing. And I certainly think with the Enjoy by IPA, we've achieved that. You know, the bitterness is over 80 in that beer, but it doesn't taste like it. You know, it tastes bitter, but it doesn't taste that high. And so that's been an interesting technique.
Yeah, I had that the other night. It's a tasty beer.
Yeah, thank you.
To be simplistic about it, everybody who had a sample of it really loved it. So,
well, thank you. Yeah, that's awesome. It's very different for us, you know, the way we approach the hopping on that, which was kind of the point. You know, we wanted to kind of do something radically different with the beer, or not, you know, maybe not radical, but, you know, for us, it was a departure. And that was part of the, you know, when Greg said he wanted to do this beer, I said, can I take the opportunity to do a beer this way, you know, with this kind of hopping, would you mind? And he said, no, go for it, you know, so that's what we did.
So let's do kind of a speed round with questions.
Okay.
Scott from Facebook says, I'd love to hear his thoughts about late addition hops versus dry hopping and which you prefer. So you talked a bit about hop bursting there, but compare and contrast the two.
Yeah, you know, I like a lot of late addition hops. You run into some brew house problems with a lot of late addition hops, you know, if you're concerned with that kind of thing about getting good troop separation and good wort clarity and actually getting some wort off of the brew. I think they both have a place. If you're brewing an IPA, I think you need to do both. And I think the late hops, you're going to get some flavor. You're also going to get a significant amount of bitterness from those as well. You're going to lose some flavor through fermentation. You know, so you're going to get some flavor scrubbing with the late addition hops. So you can't use one in place of the other. And I think you need to do both.
Chad asks, has Mitch experimented with mash hopping? You talk a little bit about it in the book.
Yeah. You know, mash hopping is a funny thing. We've done it a few times here. We actually do mash hopping with the Enjoy by IPA. We don't know if we get anything out of it or not. And it's funny because every single beer I've had that's been mash hopped has also been dry hopped to death, you know. So whether you're getting any sort of incremental hop intensity from the mash hop or flavor, I haven't been able to tell because everything has been so heavily hopped later in the process. And so That's one of the things that we're trying to look at right now and trying to understand whether there's some validity to the mash hopping, whether you keep more flavor. And we don't really have the means to do it besides sensory. You know, we're not Sierra Nevada. We don't have a lot of those sensory analyzers or flavor analyzers that they do. But I certainly am curious about it. And, you know, we do it because we think it's kind of cool to do. It's fun, and we like doing it, you know, and it's nice to say. And but what we get out of it, we haven't been able to put any sort of quantification to at all. I know there are brewers that swear by it, you know, that they, you know, the hop flavor components bind with some malt components and then don't get volatilized off. How important that is in brewing an IPA, I don't really know. I doubt it has a whole lot of significance, but, you know, it's still kind of cool to do.
And is mash hopping similar enough to be to a first wort hopping to be basically the same thing?
Well, that's one of the questions out there. You know, intuitively, I would say yes, because it kind of depends on how quickly, you know, you come to a boil. But if you're getting a significant amount of time where the hops are steeping in 150, 160 degree wort or mash, I can't see where it makes difference whether you know, it's a liquid form or, a mash form. But I don't know for sure. My intuition tells me that they'd be pretty similar.
Derek from Twitter asks, which hops has he found to be most complementary with each other? And then Kenneth on Facebook asks, which American hops do not go together? So,
I've gotten that question before. those are great questions. I love the blend of Simcoe and Amarillo. You get the piney and the cattiness from the Simcoe, but you tone it down with this kind of mellow tropical fruit intensity from the Amarillo. Centennial works great with Columbus, with Chinook. Centennial works great with any sea hop. One of the nice blends we've tried recently was Centennial and Citra in a dry hop blended together, and that was just absolutely phenomenal. And we did a beer. Just a small batch, we took some Stone IPA, which is dry hopped with Centennial, and then did a second dry hop with Motueka from New Zealand. And boy, that was just a fruit bomb. It was just beautiful. My favorites change every year as we try new things, you know, but I think that's probably a good place to start.
Clashes.
Flavor combinations.
Are there clashes, any that clash? Yeah.
To me, Columbus is a hop that can clash with other hops sometimes. And, the one exception to the Centennial with any sea hop is Centennial and Columbus didn't work for us. And maybe, you know, there's a lot of variation in Columbus supply in the flavor characteristics of that, you know, how garlicky it is or how not garlicky it is. I remember when Columbus first came out, it didn't have as much, it seemed to be more citrusy than it comes across as now, but that may be just our supply or whatever. But that was a hop we kind of struggled with using as a dry hop. It just didn't seem to blend well with anything. Other than that, not really. I mean, I think, you know, I haven't seen any real bad flavor results, you know. Sometimes Chinook can be a little overwhelming and can overwhelm the other hop, but in general, if you create a good blend proportion. You don't have to use 50-50, you know. You just have to watch it because it can kind of overwhelm. I think it's fun to blend hops. I think it's, sometimes the impact can be synergistic and where you get more than the sum of the two parts. And that's kind of what we saw with the Simcoe Amarillo. So that's the one that sticks out in my head as being particularly nice.
Jeremy from Twitter asks about using rye in an IPA.
I do like using grains like rye in an IPA. I think it adds, malt flavor complexity but doesn't add sweetness or anything that'll overwhelm the hops. So a rye IPA to me is a really nice beer. I say a lot in the book about minimizing use of crystal malts in IPA, and I believe it's important. There's a couple of reasons why, but number one, it just adds a level of sweetness and malt intensity that really can not clash, but can kind of mask the hop character if you use a lot of crystal malt. And then as the beer ages, the crystal malt immediately turns into that dried raisin fruit character, which really knocks the hop character down. Brewing an IPA with a grain like rye or wheat or something like that, or even a light Munich malt, you can get a lot of malt complexity and get a very complex beer, but still maintain that really good hop intensity that you want in an IPA. So I'm a big fan of using rye. I don't like doing it here in our brewery because our beers don't louder well with rye, but we'd like to have a rye IPA in our lineup if we can get them through the louder ton, but we just can't seem to do it.
It is sticky. I've made a 100% malted rye beer, and I wouldn't recommend it.
Ooh.
It tasted great, but it's a bit cough syrupy.
Yeah. It's a tough grain to brew with.
Rudy Bob asks, or he says, the IPA book is great, but doesn't specify lengths of time on whirlpools. And then also Phil's Brewing on Facebook says, I'd like to hear his thought about Whirlpool hops, what character they add, how to measure their impact on IBUs, and as a home brewer, when to add them to replicate a professional Whirlpool edition. So,
okay. I didn't get into time on the Whirlpool and the recipe because everybody was different and nobody really gave me that number. There's kind of some standards that, with a Whirlpool process, you're going to have, a 10 to 15 minute rest time as you allow the trub to settle out. And then it's usually, for most brewers, it's about 45 minutes to pump the wort out of the Whirlpool and into a fermenter. So, those are kind of standards across the industry, so I didn't really talk about that a whole lot. Whirlpool hopping, we use a lot of it at Stone, and I've become a big fan of it. You get a lot of character out of Whirlpool hopping, more so than late kettle hopping. If you want to replicate what professional brewers do, just simply add the hops, turn off the flame on your boil, and then add the hops, and then stir your wort. And you're pretty much, you got it. I mean, most brewers, what they're doing is just dumping hops into an empty whirlpool and then transferring the wort over into it. Those brewers that have separate whirlpools. If you're a pub brewer or a small brewer that you whirlpool in the kettle, typically you turn the flame off, you shut the heat supply off, and then you add the hops and then do your circulation. So that's kind of the way it goes. We tend to load up on the Whirlpool hops here at Stone, and we get a lot of flavor out of that, depending on the hop variety and the beer, of course. I remember just a kind of an anecdotal story. The very first Enjoy By IPA that we brewed here at Stone, we tasted the beer before it had been dry hopped, and we do that every morning. We taste fermenters and stuff, and we tasted this beer, and it was so hoppy coming out of the fermenter before we even dry hopped it. We knew it was going to be just a hop monster. It was like, oh my God, did we already dry hop this? kind of conversation. And you do get a fair amount of hopping. Bitterness out of the Whirlpool hops as well. We are in the process of doing some studies to try and quantify that and look at utilization numbers, but it looks like the utilization numbers are, somewhere in the 10% range, maybe 15%. So you do get a surprisingly large amount of bitterness from the hop addition in the Whirlpool.
And that's got to depend on the temperature that you keep that wort at and the length of time, and different systems are going to have different setups.
Certainly, yeah. And, you need to be above 185 Fahrenheit, I believe, to actually isomerize the alpha acids and get some bitterness. So most people, when they're in a Whirlpool, the wort's going to be higher than that. It's going to be 190 to 200 or so. So you're not getting the physical activity of the boil and the movement of the wort and that kind of thing, but you are getting this kind of gentle isomerization of the alpha acids. And it was surprising. Like I said, we're gonna try and present at the Craft Brewers Conference some of this information, but we're just really kind of dialing into that now, trying to understand it better.
Jake and Tom on Facebook are asking about, basically, what hops age the best, or how do you maintain that nice, bright hop flavor in the beer over time?
Yeah, great question. I think if anybody had the real, the one answer to that, they'd be very successful. It's a constant battle. The one thing that we're kind of looking at right now is doing multiple huge, varieties in the late kettle additions. That seems to really help with retaining hop character. It doesn't necessarily seem to be varietal specific with the hops. One thing that we are seeing that might have a role that we're just starting to kind of talk about is whether the yeast strain has an impact on that as well. And that's come from conversations and things that we've done with Belgian yeast, that the beer just seems to age forever and maintain that fresh hop character and not get that real dry malt papery character. Compared to a beer fermented with an ale yeast, the same beer. So we're trying to understand that. I don't know if there's anything to it or not, but the one thing that I think has surprised me over the past few years with some of the beers that we've brewed, and the first one I saw this in was a collaboration beer we did with home brewer Kelsey McNair here in San Diego. He won a contest we had at the brewery, and with him and Colby from Ballast Point, we brewed a, we called it San Diego Session Ale or Session IPA, but it was a 4.2% hopped like a double IPA.
Wow.
So a lot of hop varieties, a lot of late hop varieties, kind of the, similar to this bursting hop bursting technique. And that beer, we thought that beer would have a 90-day shelf life at best when we released it, and it tasted great 6 months later.
Wow.
It was unbelievable how well that beer aged. And again, there weren't any crystal malts in the beer to speak of, and it was just a lot of different hop varieties, very big late additions. So I think that all worked in its favor. So those are the kind of things I'm focusing on trying to understand this whole thing. But I don't have the answers, and nobody really does yet. But those are the kind of things we're looking at.
So maybe the late hop additions give you a more stable hop character over time than dry hopping?
That's what we're wondering. Yeah. If it just kind of augments the dry hop character. Dry hop character seems to just blow off pretty quick. But if you have a lot of late hops to back it up, then it looks like, without coming out and saying it for sure, but it looks like that really helps maintain some of that hop intensity throughout the life of the beer.
Well, I know you're busy. I know you've got good beer to brew. So, oh, and my buddy Brian Sorensen says, ask him when they're bringing Stone to Arkansas, because we're in Northwest
Arkansas.
Arkansas. And we're close to Missouri. Missouri is about an hour's drive from here, so we're not too bad off. It's not as bad as driving to California. So,
yeah, no kidding.
Best of luck with your expansion, and hopefully we can get some closer to home. But
yeah, I hope so. We tend to expand into areas that have, have that demand, and if, the joke used to be here at Stone, if we had a file folder that was, so high, that meant we had to start thinking about going into that state, file folder with letters from people from that state. And that's kind of how we approach it, it's like when there's demand, an overwhelming demand, that's when we start talking about it. So
talk to the Avery guys about how much IPA they sell in Northwest Arkansas. That might have an impact.
Yeah, that's would be a fun conversation, I'm sure.
Well, Mitch,
awesome.
I appreciate your time. This has been great. And I mean, we've not even scratched the surface. So maybe we can get together again one day.
Yeah, that'd be great, James. Thank you.
Well, thanks again to Mitch. If you haven't visited the Stone World Bistro and Gardens in Escondido, California, you should make it a destination. It is a beautiful place. And in addition to the wonderful beers there, the food is also excellent. And be sure to check out Mitch's book, of course. It's a good one. IPA, Brewing Techniques, Recipes, and the Evolution of India Pale Ale. I know that there are more than a few of those recipes in the back of the book that I'm looking forward to playing with. Don't forget to send us your brewing disaster stories. You can send those to, along with any brewing questions or show suggestions or whatever you want to send, send it to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site, along with combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can find our shirts in the store, too. And don't forget, our Brewer's Logbooks are now on the store, available to order, and they are going out by the bunches every day, and we greatly appreciate that. You can see a listing of the fine folks who sell our DVDs across the country on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Husqvarna 460 Rancher 20-inch 60.3cc 2-stroke X-Torque gas-powered chainsaw and Bella Whoopie Pie Maker. Thanks again. That's just a fun thing to say. Thanks again, and remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Lots of stuff to choose from this week, so y'all are wearing out that link. We greatly appreciate it. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.